This is Wilma Warren on September 17th, interviewed by Brian Clark. Formalities out of the way.
Okay.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about TAP. Why were you interested?
Well, I didn't know what I was doing when I was hired by Bristol Hardin, because there had never been, the community action agencies were just forming in the United States as a result of the war on poverty legislation that the President Johnson got the Congress to pass. But it really had come from the Kennedy. He was part of the Kennedy and the Johnson assault on the poverty and those issues. And so they hired Bristow Hardin, who was, he had worked with the public schools and with the public radio for at least 15 years before that here in Roanoke. And he was well suited for the job because he was an actor. He had an MFA in drama. And he wanted to be in the big time, and he went up there for a while and began to get some work and realized he really didn't want to do that. He wanted to come back to someplace. He grew up in Virginia Beach, but he wanted to come back to a community where he could raise his family and live a life that he thought was worth. Mm-hmm. And he could make a contribution, and he certainly did. So anyway, when Cabell Brand, you know who he is?
I do, actually.
All right. When Cabell Brand, he's the person that just, he read about this legislation, and he said, that's for Roanoke. And so he took, I forgot how much leave, I think it was a year, but maybe it wasn't that long, leave of absence from his company, and he organized the Community Action Agency of TAP, and including he was instrumental in hiring Bristow as the first director. And as they say, that really was the beginning of TAP. And it was just a wonderful new way of looking at community life. Mm-hmm. Now it seems, we're used to it. But when we first started TAP, one of the ideas that we had to say we would introduce was that the board of directors and all other boards and other governing groups that were organized by TAP had to have one-third membership from the low-income community. Well, people said that won't work at all. Said they've never done. Said, what do the poor people know about running an organization? Well, to begin with, that was one of the best experiences I ever had. I had some doubts, but I had worked with low-income people enough to know that they were certainly smarter than the average bear thinks they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so. That was, let me see, Cabell and Bristow went all over the Roanoke Valley, they ended up with TAP having, I think, 7 counties and covering Roanoke City, Roanoke County, and 6 other counties geographically adjacent. And then they had representatives, I forgot what we called them, but they were like many boards of directors from in other words, we tried to diffuse power rather than
centralize. Yep.
And that really was interesting, too, because a lot of people, and the people who opposed that didn't oppose it, I realize, just because they didn't want to lose power. They opposed it because they weren't familiar with it. It was just an unheard of sort of idea. And as it turned out, I just want to quickly say that the low-income people became the strongest members of our boards over the years. They had the most to contribute, and they could contribute, and they did contribute. And it was really wonderful.
A huge vested interest.
Pardon?
A huge vested interest.
Oh, yes. But see, before, for instance, when the first daycare center was open, we had trouble filling the slots. I think we had 90 slots. It was the one in the old building that burned later. There was a large daycare, so
okay.
There was a building, TAP building was on Shendo Avenue. It was a big old flour mill, the Lindsay Flour Mill.
Okay.
And it burned on Christmas Eve in 1998, 99, one of those years. Mm-hmm. It was a terrible thing. It was the biggest fire I ever saw in my life. It was cold, cold, cold. But anyway, what was I saying? About the
talking about the kids.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
And then they couldn't fill the
slots.
Well,
we thought people would be knocking the doors down. We thought we'd have to do, we thought our big, first big, really public relations problem would be that we wouldn't have enough room for these kids. We found out that not only were the kids not coming, the reason the parents didn't want to put them in there was because, one, they thought it was too good to be true. They thought there was a catch. And the other was that they thought they would have to disclose how much money income they had, and that somehow or another that would be used against them no matter what their income was. Mm. And so they just were so used to being untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. No, untrusted, mm-hmm. not untrustworthy. That they, and so when we found that out, then Bristol had a lot of us just go out and knock on doors in the neighborhoods and talk to the people. And so we soon got enough kids to open that daycare. And it was a huge success.
I bet.
One of the happiest, one of the best memories I have about that daycare. It was in the old TAP building. Mm-hmm. So it meant with the workers, all of us who worked in that building, and the kids and the daycare center was in the building that Lindsay, the Lindsay Mills people had built for their office, general office there.
Okay.
It was attached to the old mill part. And we all shared restrooms, so whenever you go to the restroom, there'd be these little girls down there talking, and they were so cute. And I remember one thing I just remember so well. We had put a full-length mirror up on the wall, and this little girl, she was a pudgy, little pudgy black girl with the prettiest hair. She was a pretty little thing, and she had wrapped her arms around herself and was kissing herself in the mirror and said, "Oh," she said, "you're so beautiful, you're so beautiful." And I said to myself, that's our job, you know, to make sure she never forgets how beautiful she is. And she didn't. She did very well, we understand.
That's amazing.
Isn't that a great story?
And what was your role there?
I had been with Bristol Harden Secretary of Wesleyan School, so I was a bookkeeper secretary. Then you realize it became a multi-million dollar outfit very quickly when we got our first big funding, but I had no experience in that kind of bookkeeping, but it was so simple, you know. A local CPA, Mr. Bowman, I believe it was, set up for us, showed me how to do it. But it was so simple, you know. And then we had about that first grant was for I think $90,000. That was mostly staff people to get the rest of it started, and so. So that's what I did, but then I quickly became also a program writer, an idea person, because, eight or nine people on that grant. And so we put together, with Cabell's help and a lot of volunteers, you know, getting information, because the Office of Community Services, which was the organization in Washington that funded us, they had done an excellent job of telling us what they needed to know, which also we needed to know too, to develop programs. They helped us learn what it was we needed. I don't think they've ever gotten, you know, you talk about the bureaucracy so much, and I agree there's a lot of it that's bad, but that was really done well. And it taught me, it taught all of us so much about what it is and how to account for what we did, you know, and to develop numbers of people helped and how they were helped rather than just talking about it.
Right.
And we were among the first of the government agencies to really do that, because they were so afraid that if we didn't do a good job like that, that we would quickly be defunded and that would be the end of us. And we had some bad apples, not gotten wrong, thank God, but, you know, in the United States, there were some people who really didn't obey the laws, and they got unfunded, that was bad, yeah, but boy, we always felt, and Bristol just pounded into our heads, he said, we have two equally important jobs to do. One he was talking to the staff, but really he meant the board too, he said, one is to develop a program and keep to it and deliver, and the other is to be sure that we kept our money stuff straight, and he was so open with the press, you know, no secrets were hidden, nothing was hidden with Bristol. And that was important too to learn. And so I always taught my staff that too, it's not enough to have a good heart and all that, even to deliver programs well, without being responsible to the money.
That's true.
Responsible for the money. So anyway, I don't know how I got into that, but that's the thing about the early days of that program was just wonderful. It was TAP was also the first program of any size that I'm aware of that had an integrated, racially integrated staff. Except there was one other I found out later, and that was the YWCA.
Okay.
For us, they had a racially integrated staff where, well, to me, it was the first time that I know of in Roanoke where blacks and whites worked together as peers. That was important to me. And it was a wonderful experience. And
I bet.
Because that's what I felt so much since 1954, when they started desegregating the schools, the thing I felt was that the schools would never really be desegregated in a way I thought would be fair until whites and blacks had peer relationships, mm-hmm. friendships, And that's what happened here. And I know when we first started, we'd go to restaurants, they realized they had to see this, a mixed, mixed group. But there were some that didn't like it at all, and I had friends who I thought were my friends who wouldn't speak to me when they'd see me at lunch with some of the black employees. But it just, it was hard for everybody.
Yeah.
It was hard for everybody, but it was harder for the blacks than it was for the whites, and that's the thing I think.
Yeah.
But it was hard.
Well, I bet.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's been... A lot of that has transitioned into other issues
from
my generation growing up. So to hear you just to go out to eat with your coworkers to a mm-hmm. restaurant and that's the things you don't think
all
about.
Right. Well, for instance, I remember once all these are early mm-hmm. stories. We had this big meeting one day, one Saturday, I remember, and there were a lot of local people who worked in other nonprofits. And I remember one of this young man who was an assistant minister of one of the local churches. And he's from out of town, and we were talking about how, people were discriminated against in getting jobs, and he was so innocent, and he sat there, and I'll never forget, he said, I don't understand what you're talking about. He said, what do you mean that blacks are discriminated against? I said, how do you prove it? I said, okay. I said, I'll give you a phone book, and I'll mark places in their businesses to go to, and you go and you tell me how many blacks you see working in anything but menial jobs, cleaning or serving food or serving the white. Well, he didn't say anything. He still wasn't satisfied, and I said, I don't know of a single business in this town. No, I really don't, because I remember the only one that I do remember was, and this it was a menial job, is that the man who Bristow hired as one of his assistant directors. He was a college graduate. He never had a job, though, where he could really work, do what he had taken in college. He was an orderly for Louisville Hospital, and he carried my children in. After they had their shots to get their tonsils out. I remember him as well as anything, and then the next time I met him, he became the director of the Community Action Agency in Warrington, one of the best in the country. And it's just that kind of thing. But that's how I think we were just blinded to the fact of how we took for granted the way that people live and the way we treated other people.
It's hard looking past what's socially accepted.
Oh, yeah.
And when everybody's looking at it, you might have a few, such as yourself, where they notice that distinction, but, the larger culture isn't really...
And the reason that I noticed it, too, mainly my mother and father, especially my father, I grew up in Bridgewater, the valley.
Up near Harrisonburg?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And in the early 30s, up to, I graduated from high school in 45, I started school in 33.
Okay.
And my dad was on the school board there for a number of years, and Bridgewater is a small town, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I can remember him so well saying, every time in Bridgewater, if there was a fire, they had a volunteer fire department, so the siren went off downtown. Everybody knew there was a fire. And I know my dad always stopped, and he said his heart just kind of stopped because he said the school that the black children went to there was so poorly, Well, they heated it with a big old pot-bellied stove that got red, burning red hot, and then they had to cool it off. It was terrible, and he said he felt so afraid that they'd have a fire before the school board could really do anything about that. And, you know, just hearing him talk about that, and he was very unusual for, you know, for that town and place. But Bridgewater was, because Bridgewater College, see, the Brethren Church were always very racially, and the leaders were always very socially aware of things. And I know they were the first school I knew of that the girls' basketball team in 1951 or 52 was before the 54 decision. They forfeited the state championship to Hollins College because the championship game was going to be played at Hollins, and they could not provide a room for their two black basketball players on the Bridgewater team. Very, you know, sleep in the same place the others did, so they said, thank you, just saying you forfeit that game. You know, when you have those things happen in your life, and, you know, it's people that you know, then it becomes personal to you.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's why I was not good. I mean, it's just that I had a lot of good influences.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
I did. And anyway, let's see. I was talking about TAP. TAP, it was so wonderful because Bristol was totally unorthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not be, Cavill and I, and a lot of people tried to help him become more orthodox, but he just wouldn't do it. And I'm glad he wouldn't.
Sounds like it was a good thing in the long run.
Oh, it was. And, but his father was a famous music teacher down in Virginia Beach,
mm-hmm.
right? And how he got the way he got that is something I just don't understand. And I think some people are just born with a sensitivity to other people's pain, and I think Bristol was one of those people. And he was just so flat out and out. He's loud and raucous, but he made you realize, I mean, just, you think you knew what was right, you know, the right thing to do or something, and he'd say something, you just knew immediately, he just turned you upside down. And it was a great, great experience for us all.
You mentioned the different ways that TAP was brought into the community and how the community had to look at itself differently. What other types of things were that? I'm curious.
Well, one of the things was that we had to pay the minimum wage to lease the minimum wage. And there are some big businesses in town who resented that because they felt that TAP was hiring up the good workers because we could pay more than they paid to say they're garbage people. And that. Now, that I'm not talking about the city.
Mm-hmm.
That was one way. Another way was a lot of people, of middle-class white people, friends of mine and others, they were not at all sure that they could trust us. They weren't mm-hmm. sure of what... Well, none of us really had lived in a desegregated world, you know? And I wasn't sure either, but I knew it was right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first step. But so that there was that, then there was just the mystery of TAP, too, you know, because another thing I remember we had a march once on the newspaper because some women who were black tried to get their pictures of, you know, when they were going to get married or the pictures after they were married, mm-hmm. were put on the same page as the whites, and boy, the paper refused. And I remember we did that march, and we marched to the blood bank and gave a pint of blood. Rather than, you know, spilling blood. And that was a big thing that I it wasn't until we did it that we realized how strongly some people felt about desegregation. So it was that. To me, I was sort of innocent naive. I thought once we had to do it, people would be so glad to mm-hmm. do it. And a lot of people were, but a lot of people weren't either. It's just... A lot of it, I think, came from, you know, we remember our fathers and mothers' tapes. I think a lot of fathers' tapes, especially fathers, but it's a lot of mothers, were still in the heads of people, and it's just hard to give it up. And let me see. Well, the churches were the best platforms, white and black. The churches are the white churches and the black churches. Mostly white churches gave us room for our Head Start centers. We had, I think, 9 to start with.
Okay.
And we could never have found a place that was suitable that the health department would approve of that could be used except in churches. Mm-hmm. And a lot of churches were very generous. It was a disruption to their use of the building.
Sure.
But they've done it and still do. I don't know where all those are now, but I know that they did. And let me see. The big thing for me, just personally, was that I soon made a lot of friends, fast friends that were friends for life of people who were black and whose homes I visited. And they came, you know, we've been friends for years. And I think it was a wonderful experience for me, and I think for them too. And then there was another group of women that I organized. I didn't join it because by this time I was traveling out of the city a lot, but a lot of the women, I think there were about 30 women at least to start with over the years, and they're still meeting, and I've forgotten what they call themselves, but they're black and white. Mm-hmm. And they talk about all kinds of things that have to do with race. And it's just been a great, and that's formed our core women in this city that has just been invaluable. Teeny Harden was one. You look at the obituaries when somebody dies, you know. That was another thing. Let me see. Otherwise, well, just so I think the most important thing is the fact that it was done without violence in this city.
And done without violence.
Yeah, without violence.
Okay.
And that was partly because of Bristol and Cavill and the people. And then we also had we had some of the best leaders in the city on our first board of directors. Mm-hmm. I wrote the first legal aid grant application. It was funded, and it was passed by it had to be passed by the local bar association before they put the money in the community, and it was, and so the leaders in the law community, there were a lot of people who didn't think it was going to be a good thing, but they passed it, and that was good. You know, we've always managed, well, I said, we didn't do it, it's because there are in any community, I believe, a large number of people who believe that they should do what's right. A lot of people do what's right no matter what, and a lot of people just sort of, you know, they're scared to. And in Roanoke, in this valley, Bristol was determined that we were not going to resort to, or else, you know, we really tried not to blame anybody for what was. We were just involved in what is now and what we can change. And I think that helped us from getting so self-righteous, too, because, you know, you didn't have to look very far until you could see that you had been just as involved in the soul racism as anybody else. So, and a lot of blacks were, too, you know, mm-hmm. So there you go. It's just nobody is free of it. No. And so.
And we're still working.
Oh, I know.
Luckily for different reasons now, but still.
Oh, but I think it's always the basic reason. Is to allow as much, I think, as much freedom of choice as people want, not as possible, as freedom as people want. And I think that a lot of our problems now, you know, it's not because of the barriers of that, it's because people just haven't really awakened to the fact that they need to want that too to make it go. Well, it's just, you know, there's so many facets to it.
So it's huge. Did you live in a desegregated neighborhood?
Yes, I did, but not at first.
And where was that?
It was in Grandin Court, mm-hmm. near the Grandin Court School. I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of
it. Is that the Virginia Heights?
No, it's
Grandin Court Elementary?
Yeah, Grandin Court. That coffee pot all the way in there. Our neighbors sold their house to a black couple who were friends of mine. He worked the tap, and he didn't have any intention of trying to break into a neighborhood. He was looking for a house that he could afford, at a price he could afford, and with people he thought he liked. So he bought the house next door to us, and our neighbor that had lived there before, let me see. Yeah. I don't know. Let me see. I'm trying to think. Oh, that's right. The neighbor of the house that they bought, mm-hmm. and he lived in between us. And I understood he didn't tell us, but he said that he told some of the people in the neighborhood that if those people moved into his neighborhood, he's going to take his gun out and shoot them. Well, you can imagine I was terrified. And I heard
that because
I couldn't imagine him doing it, but you never know. And so what we did was I called Bristol and I said, what can we do? Because I didn't want Billy to know it. I thought it would be terrible for him to know it's about, you know, because I thought the man was not going to do anything. But I wasn't sure. But anyway, so we just had people, all friends of ours at TAP everywhere we knew, bring them food and come help them move in and everything. Do you know that within a year and a half, that man and his wife gave their key to Billy, not to me, to keep for them and to watch over their house while they were gone on their vacation. Now, how's that for a story?
That's a story. And that's pretty remarkable.
It is. And you know why I did it? It's because Billy loved his car. He got out there every Saturday and washed his car. I mean, and it's just things like that that make people so do such weird things. Isn't that a wonderful story? But
yeah.
It's true, and they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. They really, to me, this was not, they weren't being goody-goody or anything. They really, but they just learned by the fact that they knew them, that they were good people, and that they really had them watch their house and me.
Mm-hmm. Hey, they're the neighbor, right?
I loved it.
That's great. Now, have you lived in Roanoke all your life?
No, I was, let me see. I think I was 26 years old. No one was older than that. I mean, I was 29. I don't know. I was just under 30 years old when we moved here. I lived in Bridgewater until I was 19. Then we lived in Stanton for 2 years, and then we lived in Richmond for 7 years.
So you've been around the state a little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit.
But those, you know, you feel like you have different lives.
Mm-hmm.
I've changed so much. But I love Roanoke. It's the best, I think. I love it here.
That's good, because that's where you are.
That's right. It's been great for my children. I know, you know, you want to talk about our neighborhoods.
Children are part of neighborhoods.
That's right. Well, and also not just my personal memories of neighborhoods, but also TAP. That's really what we were about, was in helping the low-income people improve their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And because we had our motto was hands up. Instead of a hand up instead of a handout.
We use that at Habitat too.
Yeah, I know.
Yep.
And
it's a very good one.
It is, it is. Campbell, I don't know if he made it up, but it came to us from Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to remember that, but and I was thinking about that this morning. I thought, well, there's some neighborhoods that you just wouldn't have known them then, but there are still others that need a lot of help. And,
have you seen some that have improved?
Oh, yes.
Like, which ones in particular?
Well, I think some of those in Southeast now have really improved. And
like, as you're going towards Vinton? And
yeah, right, yep. right. Oh, yeah. And, I think that I can't even remember how it was, a lot of them, because they've changed so much. The Grand Road area down in there, some of the places that seem to be intractable, I don't know why, unless, like Mrs., who was the lady that did the housing in here in Northwest?
Not sure.
Was it Miss Thompson? Anyway, she started this wonderful housing group here. She was a member of elderly woman who started this program of helping people get loans for their houses, and also they got rehab loans. This whole area, well, of course, Greensboro, that's one thing, but even beyond here, you know, where the housing is, really improved a great deal. And there is some decent, some integration of neighborhoods, but not, you know, it's interesting to me. It hasn't been as much as I thought it would be, and I think that's okay as long as it's what people want. And we still have a problem in our schools, you know. I think that is a lot of it is, I don't know what a lot of it is, but I think that if you look at where the schools have had problems meeting the state standards, I think part of that is the fact that there are so many children in those schools who really come from families that they are so low income that they don't have books, they don't have many enrichment things, and I think that's important. I think it's important that parents participate in the schools, and they're not doing that in a lot of those schools to the degree that they need to do it. Whether or not, that's a whole different thing. I think I've said for years that if you went to the school system and you were made to feel less worthy, you were one of the outs people. And then when you just quit school and you got a job, you didn't want to go back to that building for any reason. And I think that's part of it. And but I think that I know that from a lot of my black friends who went to school when I was going to school, or who were my contemporaries, and they succeeded because they said there was a grandmother, a mother, there was a father, there was somebody, a mother and father, who said, "Then listen here, you are going to go to school, and you're going to do well, and you're going to go to college if we can deal with them here out of the road." I think there's not as enough of that. But there are also some wonderful programs that help, and you know, like the program that helps kids go to college. Mm-hmm. What is it called?
There's probably more than one out there now. There's
anyway,
a lot.
There are just a lot of things. I think that when I was at TAP all those years, and then I became the director of the Virginia Water Project, which is a program that helps families in rural areas obtain safe water and indoor plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
And that project was a real winner. It's all over the country. In fact, it's just a lot of places now. But I think that can you stop it when I'm tired?
That's okay. We can take our time.
I had a thought, important thought about.
No rush at all. I'll get some too. Put mine. Would you like these closed, or is this too bright?
I think so.
Okay.
I've never had to wear a sun visor. I have.
Reach over you here. Just sitting here beside you, I realized how bright it was coming in that window.
Much better.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That was worth stopping for.
It was. I didn't realize it.
Yeah, me neither.
Anyway, what was I talking about? Something I said about before I got them.
You're talking about the water project.
Right before that. It was something important about TAP in the neighborhoods.
We might have to come back to that.
Yeah, I think so. I've just about shot in the water bill on TAP, I think. What is missing? Should I talk more about it? See, I know what's going on now, but not like that. I wouldn't do it.
Well, I'm curious about a couple of things, too. One, what was it like coming to Roanoke for the first time? I mean, obviously, you became very invested here and moved on to these great things, but what was it like coming in at, you know, not quite 30 to the Roanoke Valley and living here?
It was terrible. Because from Richmond City, in Bridgewater and Harrisonburg, Harrisonburg had some nice places to shop, and we'd go to Richmond to shop. Didn't ever come to Roanoke to shop then. But, so when I came here, I was used to Milling Roads and Tallhunters, and bigger grocery stores. And when we came to Roanoke, and after a couple of weeks, I said to my husband, I really need to go downtown and buy a few things. Mm-hmm. I said, we had two children then. And I said, no, we had three, I guess. No, we had two. Anyway, I said, I need to just go down to Roanoke. So we went in the car. He sat outside with his kids parked somewhere. Well, I went in and shopped for a few things. I came back to the car just bawling. I got in the car and I bawled. He said, what happened? He said, did somebody upset you? I said, no. I said, it's awful. I said, there's no place to shop in Roanoke. It's awful. Zeronimus was the biggest store. And, you know, as I recall, I'm not swear to it, but in my mind, the floors had those oily black floors.
Mm-hmm.
Right downtown, it was just really no place good to shop. There was only two restaurants. I remember one was that wonderful seafood place out on Williamson Road, and then the other one was the New Yorker.
Which is still here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, there was really no place else you wanted to go out to at night for a nice dinner. And let me say, it was just terrible. They had good movies. They had a great theater, American Theater.
Is that the one you went to?
Yeah, it was torn down.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was a great theater. But let me see. Of course, we didn't have a Civic Center. It was just really, and the town, see, oh, railroad, the dust. Every morning, I had to wipe the windowsills out because they blacked the dust from the coal.
And where did you live close, or was that just the?
Well, I lived at Virginia Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that railroad does go by there. Let me see. I live in Southwest Roanoke,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't until I got diesel that stopped.
And that because it was the old coal steam?
Yeah. And so it was just, I mean, that's the way it was. To me, Roanoke was, I didn't want to leave because in Richmond I had missed the mountains so much that I swore I'd never live again where they didn't have the mountains.
I had that experience in Richmond, too. I lived there for about a year and a half, and when I came back, I thought, how did I not realize this?
Oh, I did. I used to lie. I used to stand at my kitchen window in the mornings after my husband would go to work, and I would cry because I couldn't see the mountain. It was just terrible, I thought. But now I go to Richmond, I don't miss the mountains because I'm used to, you know, I know they're here. But let me see, who else was Roanoke like? Roanoke, the City Hall, if you would just look back at the newspapers in those days, there were two factions. I don't even remember their names. I do, but I don't even remember them. They fought all the time. Sometimes those meetings would go past midnight. And, you know, it's amazing to me that, you know, my sister lived here. So she lived here for quite a long time, 10 years, I guess, before I came here. So she knew the territory, and she was involved with the Association of University Women, AUW. Was that the one? Anyway, they really looked at the legislation that was needed in the city, and they did a good job over the years of really getting the city sort of into modern. Well, I forgot when the city of Roanoke got the form of government we had, the city manager, and that was that was a big improvement.
Okay.
And I think
because before it was just a council.
Yeah, and the mayor had a lot more. You know.
Okay, so more one person directing as opposed to...
Well, yeah, and also, see, the mayor, that was a full-time, it became a full-time job. It just was much better the way it was. Mm-hmm. I think it may have changed before we came here or right after. I know they had put the Mill Mountain Star up. Oh, the Mill Mountain Star, I love it so now. But at first I thought it was the hokiest thing I ever saw. And at one time they were going to get rid of it. That's when those of us who had made fun of it decided mm-hmm. we wanted to keep it.
So kind of liked it that way, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was here when you got here?
Yes, it just
so
was.
So, when did you come in? Sometime late 50s, 50, early
60s? No, let me see. It's 54.
So, 54. You came right as the star.
Yeah, right. Okay. Uh-huh. And, it was wonderful. But Roanoke was really a sort of a one-horse railroad town.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not knocking the fact that it's a railroad town. I think the railroad's been very good for the city in a lot of ways. And I think that as the health professionals are good for the city now. But it was a pretty hokey town compared to Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love it better by far than Richmond because, for instance, well, in the neighborhood, we lived in a good neighborhood in Richmond. And we had a lot of friends because there were a lot of young people there in those days. That was, our children were the boom, baby boom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there's something about Roanoke that I think is just essential to raising children. I'm not sure what it is, but for me it was. It's large enough so that you can have things, good libraries, good schools,
yes.
That sort of thing. But also, it's small enough so that you can know all your city people, all the elected officials. You can know your preachers, you can know you know, you are known and you know a lot of the people that are important in the city to make a change into deciding who does what. So I think that's important to what, you know, what the city has become. I think it's just miraculous. I think it's miraculous. Here I am, 81 years old. When I came here, I used to sit at St. John's in a certain place in the church. I still do. But I sat there. I was the young mother with these little children. Now I'm one of the oldest members, and I'm still sitting in the same area of the church. And I've watched, you know, this whole group of people age and die, and new leaders come up. Little kids that were little kids are now the, you know, they're the movers and shakers. And it's nice. It's a nice feeling to have experienced that.
Mm-hmm. And played quite a part yourself.
That's right. And I was glad I could. Well, you see, I didn't want to go to work at all because I thought being at home with the kids, my mother had been a great mother. You know, she provided a lot of the happiness of our family because she was home and she could. We had a lot of company for dinner. And
mm-hmm.
had a lot of parties and that sort of thing. We, you know, and our mothers in Bridgewater were the ones that made the world go round for us. They took swimming in the summertime. You know,
and they were mostly stay at home, work with the family.
Yeah, yeah,
yep.
Oh yeah. And so when I was, let me see, I just had my youngest child was 3 years old when I went to work, but it just becoming clear to us that, you know, we're going to have two wage earners in the family. So that's why I went to work, and I didn't even know Bristow needed anybody. They were friends of ours. And so I was looking for jobs, and somebody told him, and he called me, he said, why didn't you tell me you were going to go to work? So I went to there to work, but I never thought of having a career. You know, just sort of grew into it. The water project really became my signature, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And hi.
Everything going okay?
Going well. Thank you.
Yeah, I thought I'd come by and check. You're not having your group today?
Next week.
Oh, next week. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I hope that didn't hurt anything.
Oh, no.
Let me just tape. Okay.
Yeah, it's all part of it, right?
Okay, right. It is. But talking about neighborhoods, I think that Roanoke still has a way to go with neighborhoods. I'm not sure. Of course, I think Grandin Road is just a super neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
If every neighborhood could be like Grandin Road, I think we'd have a supreme town in America, in the world.
Yep.
Because it's just got everything that you need. And
are you talking like where the theater is?
Yeah,
and the
I'm thinking
about Grandin Village.
Yeah, and all the people that live around us, you know, just are drawn to that. See, we lived there after we sold our house. We lived at the there's apartments right there beside the on Brandon Road, beside the crossroad from the post office.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly where you're talking
about. In my bedroom upstairs just faced right onto Brandon Road, and early in the mornings I'd watch the mothers and the fathers go out with the little babies. There was one woman who had twins and two dogs on leashes. And how she did it, I don't know. Those were big dogs, too.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, it was. It was great. And I think that good neighborhoods, good solid neighborhoods where people, I think people need to accept each other more easily. Even though I say that, I say you just can't make people do anything, and you can't, but That I think makes more tolerant attitudes, certainly does bring more of an easier place to live for people.
Mm-hmm.
Expecting the best instead of expecting the worst, I think. Very important. And feeling safe. See, I always felt safe in Roanoke until I didn't feel so safe. We went through a period here where people were having break-ins in their houses. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, we got this beautiful silver service from my husband's family when we got married, and I was so proud of it. I would hide it in the garbage can, under the garbage, wrap it up and everything, and put it under the garbage when I'd go out of town because I'd just afraid somebody would break in. Because we had it in our neighborhood, we had a number of break-ins like that. Cars would come at night, you know, after dark, and they'd just had a good entrance to the back of the house, and they just go right into the house.
Oh my gosh!
Terrible. And that, you know, it's scary. Because I didn't like feeling that way. In Bridgewater, we had one policeman over the years.
Well, that's a little different experience.
Well, and we used to, as teenagers, you know, we would on Sunday afternoons when after we got to where we could ride in cars, we'd ride down to see Mr. Payne's name. We'd see the policeman, and then we'd take off, and then we'd go faster, and he'd chase us. I think he probably had as much fun as we did. So that was my idea of police, you know. So I didn't like living where I felt that you needed a policeman. But of course you do. But then when I moved to Roanoke, my sister and her husband were very good friends of Matt Nash and his wife, and he was one of the policemen in the first day. So that helped me with the policeman.
You get to know him, a little personal face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think neighborhoods, good neighborhoods, are the key to sanity in the world. I really do.
What were the best parts about yours?
Oh, my.
I mean,
growing up, I've written about 100 pages of my memories.
Oh, wow.
Because I just think that my children, my grandchildren need to know. Mm-hmm. It's like Camelot. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Now, you mean kind of then and now? Is that what you mean? It's like Camelot?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Camelot was supposed to be perfect, the ideal mm-hmm. place. And I swear to you, where I only rained at midnight, you know, and that sort of stuff. I think that Bridgewater was that way. And when I've written, I've deliberately left out the fact that, like, you know, when some of the fathers were alcoholics, I didn't put that in because this, I wrote it from the standpoint of the child, whatever age I was, whatever I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I finish it, I will know those things, see, but that's later on. But the best parts to me were my friends, my, mm-hmm. the families, my neighborhood. And Bridgewater was a wonderful town because during the Depression, there were a lot of people who didn't have work. My daddy was a U.S. Forest Service. He was a ranger. And he was a wonderful man. And he and my mother were very good influences in the town, but they were one of about, I'd say, at least 20 families that I can think of who were, you know, some of those families that had a really hard time financially. See, at least my daddy got a paycheck every week or every month or whatever it was. And he wasn't afraid of being fired, losing his job. That made a big difference. But mother and daddy, and I'd say at least 8 women. My mother and about 8 other women. And I'm not sure who they all were during those years. Like, I have 2 friends from families that, like in one family, they had 6 children, and the father was a college graduate, and he made $12 a week as a parts manager of the local car dealership. So my mother sewed. She'd go to Harrisonburg, and she'd go to Harrisonburg and get material for me for a skirt or a dress or whatever. She'd get similar material, but never the same, for one of my friends in that family. And she'd make us both. I remember, I think, we had these pleated skirts,
mm-hmm.
and mother would make them. And then what we did was we'd just share them, you know. We'd some days, some nights, Frances would, she'd have some, and I'd have the other. But, so they did that. They just made sure that, and it was always very quiet. See, I wasn't even aware of it till after I was grown, you know, what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the women, Miss Allen, whose husband was from a wealthy Boston family, she'd take the kids up there. Well, her children would go up there in the summer, and they'd go to camp and things like that. Then she'd go up the last 2 weeks of August. And she would go shopping. She'd shop for their winter clothes. And I didn't know it until one time. I just happened to be at the people's house. You know, the man was telling me that. She gave us all these boxes from Vilene's in Boston. She bought winter coats for all those kids. She bought one nice dress.
Wow. So just everybody taking care of their neighbors
mm-hmm.
and friends.
Really. And that she never said that. Mother may have known. I don't know if she ever did. I didn't tell anybody. I wasn't told not to. I just thought, you know, I knew I shouldn't. And yes, it really, I tell you, people made fun of Hillary Clinton's, you know, it takes a village, but it's the truth. That's what it took. Oh, like Mrs., she was the darlingest little woman, Miss Maddie Loudon. She lived on Main Street of Bridgewater, and she did this little pen and ink. She did calling cards and wedding invitations and that sort of thing. And she also did some trays for wedding presents. And she'd sit there and do it, and we would go calling. When I was a little girl, you know, living in Bridgewater, and there were a lot of small town there, they might work like dogs in the morning, but in the afternoons they'd take a bath and they'd get changed and they'd go and put their hats and gloves on, and they'd go calling. And so mother would take me because I was the youngest, and that she couldn't leave me at home by myself. And she put this color, big ribbon in my hair right here. Do it like this. I hated that. But I loved to go calling though, because I could just sit quietly and just listen. It was wonderful. So she took me to Miss Maddie's. Miss Maddie was the sweetest woman, and she really was. I mean, she's so sweet and quiet. God, you can't imagine women being like that anymore. And anyway, there were a number of people who lived on Main Street of Bridgewater. Well, anytime any of us did anything that happened on Main Street, where most of our air action did, our mothers got a phone call from one of these women. They said, "Miss Casey, I just saw a woman, Jean, do something I never thought I'd see her do." They're always nice about it.
That's a big family watching over you.
It was. I played hooky one day in my whole life because I liked school so much, and finally my friend said, "You've got to play hooky." So we decided we would stay at one day. We'd go stay at this girl's house who lived on Main Street. Now, wasn't that a dumb thing for us to do?
It was smart at the time, right?
It was dumb. We couldn't get out. We couldn't stay in that house for somebody to see us.
Yeah.
Till 3 o'clock in the afternoon was the dumbest thing I ever did. And then my sister, who taught in school, she taught in the high school, she said to me, she said, "Woman Jean," she said, "where were you today? Dinner. We were all at the table." I said, "I was at school." She said, "No, you weren't." That was it, see? So I got caught. I thought I had not gotten caught, but I got caught. I think feeling that, I don't know how other people feel. All I know is my own experience. I know I don't know. I've never known anybody. In Bridgewater, we used to say, if you didn't grow up in Bridgewater, you didn't grow up. That's what we tell other people. But I think that there was a protection and a pride. See, all these people, they were proud of all of us, too. It wasn't just their child. You know, they didn't pit us against each other like I see a lot of parents.
I was going to ask if you had, if you felt a competition sort of thing, which is what I've experienced in a lot of ways.
No. And I don't think my mother and dad were any different. I think the brethren, church had a influence. All the churches that we used to say, there were more churches than people in Bridgewater. And there were. I think the churches had a big influence, but I also think, during the war years that we had conscientious objectors at the college, we had just a little bit of everything. And one of the guys that was a conscientious objector was one of the greatest guys. He was the most popular kid ever grew up in Bridgewater. And when he was in college, you know, he really worried about it. He sweated over it. He just felt his conscience. He had to do it, but he had people who just really refused to wait on him in stores and things like that.
And this was in World War II, right?
Yeah. And my daddy was so mad when he heard that. He said, "What do these people think they're fighting a war for?" You know, he said, "To stop that kind of stuff." He said, "We knew him well enough to know he would much prefer not to have been a conscientious objector, but he was. And he was, and he was."
Mm-hmm.
And so, but those are the things I think about Bridgewater being so good for me. Experiences that I had that a lot of my contemporaries really didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, is this a lot of the memories that you've written down about?
Oh, yeah.
What's your motivation? I'm just curious. You mentioned something about you think it's important for your
your
children.
My daddy was a great storyteller. He was from Arkansas,
mm-hmm.
so So I remember as a child hearing him tell all the stories about he's growing up in the Ozarks. And funny, you know, and also wonderful stories and wonderful people. And because the pictures of them, they looked awful, you know, they were, oh, well, they looked like pioneers, and that's what they were. But and other people like my, some of my friends in Bridgewater, you know, had very patrician-looking families. Well, mine weren't like that. They were Irish, and they were good pioneers. But anyway, I think that what was I talking about?
See, I'd ask you why you feel it's important to kind of preserve these memories.
It is. Because, like, I was not in it. My daddy and his brother wrote a family history over the years. And I thought it was kind of cute, you know, nice, and I read it as a progressive. It wasn't until I was about 30, I guess, where I really appreciated it. And I think that my children are best way, and see my grandchildren there come along. I think that they'll come and they'll sit with us, what I've written. And every one of them won't, probably, but some of them will. And they'll be preserved, and they'll say, listen, I remember, you know, like, every time an airplane went over Bridgewater, everybody in town would have said, see the airplane. That,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was so infrequent?
Yeah.
Huh.
And
now it's every day.
Yeah. And see, my dad, and then they had barnstormers that came around. And I remember when I was 5 years old, and Daddy was after church after we'd eaten lunch on Sunday, and Daddy said, well, Gene, how would you like to go see the barnstormers? I didn't know what they were, but I said, I'd like to go. So he and Mother and I went up to the country. I said, this right outside of Bridgewater, to one of the farmer's big field. And there were lots of cars around, and there was one airplane. And the man was dressed just like Charles Lindbergh's pictures. I thought it was Lindbergh. I really did. And so we went out there, and the plane came down about the time we got out of the car. And I don't remember what he looked like, but I thought he was handsome. You know, jock for pants and the leather and the leather cap. And so we watched them two or three times. They came and went, and Daddy looked down at me once, and he put his hand on my head, and he said, well, didn't you say, how would you like to ride that airplane? I said, I never dreamed $5 was a lot of money. Was then. And so I said, I'd like it. I thought I would. Of course, I'd scared to death. But I didn't ride an airplane again for a long time.
But you did there.
Oh, I did there. And I just thought it was the most exciting thing in the world because Charles Lindbergh was taking me up in the air. I went to school the next day and told my friend, you know, I was in kindergarten. I said, I went riding in the airplane with Charles Lindbergh. I don't know if they believe me or not. I never even thought to ask him after I realized what I'm doing. But anyway, you know, that was the kind of thing that just, it's hard for kids now for you to probably imagine a world like that.
It is.
And yet it was so interesting. Like, we had a Victrola. We danced to a Victrola. Oh, God, it was terrible. But, you know,
was that the one with the big...
No, ours didn't. It was just one generation ahead of that.
Okay.
After that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was square oak. It looked beautiful, you know, we thought it was. And people would... Yeah, I know my brothers and sisters, they'd haul around to people's houses because we had dances in our home.
Oh, okay. You know?
And that was fun, and like when we'd have a dance, I could invite my friends to come and we'd dance, and then the older boys would dance with the girls, and we'd wear a little evening dress. So that's the kind of thing our mothers did. They made life wonderful for us in this little town. Oh, they thought when we started dancing, we needed a teacher. Well, they didn't know we could already do the dances, and so they hired this man from Harrisonburg. I'll never forget him. Nobody wanted to go to his dancing lessons, and that didn't last long. I was happy for that. But I took art lessons from a woman who later taught. She was the art professor at Madison College. Mm-hmm. Her husband was postmaster in Bridgewater. And she, just things like that that I had so many advantages that you just can't imagine a kid in a little town like Bridgewater having all the advantages. Oh, at Bridgewater College, see, they had Cole Hall, and they had all kinds of wonderful programs there. For instance, did you ever hear of the black school in Tennessee? They had these wonderful, they had singers, this, what is it? what they call anyway. Well, they were famous all over the world. They became this wonderful black chorus that sang all over the world and to raise money for their college. And once, and they got too uppity apparently for some of the locals at one time, and they burned down their one of their buildings.
Ooh.
Terrible. But anyway, I remember going to that. My mother was president of the women's club. See, they had a women's club, and the women's club, they just did everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they raised money for the cafeteria at our school. And the hot Julie, Fitz Julie Singers.
Okay.
And you can look them up in the...
Fitz Julie Singers.
They're on the...
Are they still around?
No. But this was... Yeah, but they're on there in the, on the internet.
Okay.
I've got all... Oh, like CCC.
Mm-hmm.
See, my daddy was with the Forest Service, which was in charge of the CCC camps in our area. And CCC, some areas the Forest Service was in charge of, and some areas the state Forest Service was, and other people. But under George Washington, my daddy was in charge of all the CCC camps. And that was a wonderful experience because, I mean, for me, for a kid, well, the man who was in charge of it in the summertime was Mr. Hopper, who was my dad's assistant ranger. And they had a son married, so they invited me up there for 2 weeks to stay. Well, you know, that's a really... Because those men were wonderful, they just couldn't find work.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so nice to us. And like, they pitched horseshoes at night, I remember, you know, just wonderful. And, but I would never have appreciated... I think one of the reasons I really remember the Depression so well is because of that. And the other thing was is that the men there would call Daddy on Friday nights and Saturdays and Sundays. They'd get so homesick. And they'd call Daddy and they'd cry on the phone. You know, they'd say, Mr. Casey, I'm so, so homesick. And so I feel like, and Daddy never once, I never heard him say, I wish they'd leave me alone or anything. He'd sit for hours and talk to them on the phone. And And they built, though, they built Home Quarry, they built Skyline Drive, they built all...
Delirious Park Quarry.
They, did you ever go to the one that huge snow thing in Washington State? It's a snow, it's a big snow lodge.
Okay.
It's four stories, and I was there once, I was an adult then, but it's on that loop, you know, that goes around
Oregon.
Not Rainier, it's Oregon, see, other one. It's Mount Hood.
Oh, okay.
Mount Hood. Anyway, they, you know, the CCC built that. And so in my writing, I had to do research. Well, for instance, I remember for sure that my daddy, I knew Daddy was at the dedication. See, Camp Shenandoah, which was the one up near Shenandoah, Virginia, that was number one, that was the first CCC camp to be open. And Franklin Roosevelt came and he made the speech, and Daddy was there. Well, I started writing it, I thought, you know, I want to write this without making sure it really happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in touch with the librarian at the Library of Congress, and I told, you know, my email, I told her what I was looking for, and she emailed me the nicest email back. She gave me all kinds of websites, and she said, indeed, you're right, and your daddy was there probably, no doubt, but she gave me some of the stuff that he said that day, including. He said to the men, he always said that the CCC was the best program he ever started. And she said that day when he spoke to them, his speech says he starts out by saying, my boys.
Mm-hmm.
And, so anyway, that was wonderful. And I researched a lot of this stuff because I didn't want, I thought, in the first place, you can't trust your memory.
It does funny things.
Don't tell me, I know
I'm learning.
I swear I remember so-and-so. I might remember, but it wasn't that way it was. But most of these stories I was able to track back.
Mm-hmm.
And have. The other thing I've got in there, though, like, for instance, we had in our gang, in our neighborhood, on our street, Broad Street gang. And every other kid in town wanted to be a part of that gang, and so they gradually let some of me in. But the boys were pretty much the ringleaders, and my brother Harry, he was wonderful. Harry was, he was 5 years older than I. He was the youngest, next youngest son to me. And he was such a popular kid. He was so popular because he just liked everybody, you know. I don't know what his secret was, but I can remember that I'd follow along behind Harry and his gang. And sometimes I'd get up close to him, and one of his friends would say, Harry, send Angel home. That's what they call him. And he said, send Angel home, because I was such a little rebel. And Harry said, she stays. And I stayed. So there were those kind of things that I remember that I've written about. And anyway, every year they had a great apple battle. And it was right in the lot between our house and the village, like three lots of the big field. And for weeks ahead of time, they'd have it about the second week in August, when the apples began to be on the ground, and because this was formerly an apple orchard, so there was still a lot of trees there. There wasn't an orchard, but there was a lot of apple trees. So they'd two sides by, with a baseball bat, and how they used to do it. And he was on whose team, and they had, and so then they spent weeks collecting apples off the ground and making slingshots out of branches and limbs out of inner rubber shoes. That's what they do. And then the day of the great battle was wonderful. I tell you, when you read about battles of war, that's, I always think about it, because that's the way it was. And we were so little, they wouldn't let us play, but we had one of the outhouses at our yard. We'd go in there and look out the window and watch the team. And of course, we'd always be for the team, whoever it was that was on our side of the house. And anyway, it was so wonderful. Nobody ever got hurt. Nobody ever got hit with an apple that I remember. And yet, it was an all-day ordeal. Hot, it'd be hot, I remember that. And the one thing I wrote at the end of that, I said, wouldn't it be wonderful if humans could settle their differences with apple battles rather than bombs? I swear, it just seemed so simple to me, and had a lot more fun.
Oh, much.
It was wonderful.
Much.
But, too, there was so much of that kind of stuff going on. It was a very creative kind of a community. And the one reason I know it was, but I've been amazed at how well some of the kids have done. Like one of them one was a president of a phone company up in New England. One was a dean of the School of Architecture at the University of Virginia. A lot of doctors, a lot of teachers, a lot of, I'm just trying to think of, you wouldn't think a little town like that would produce this many leaders. There are a lot of leaders. And I just know it was really a special environment. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe a lot of people could write the same story.
But it was for you. But
for me, it was.
That's important.
It really was.
What kind of, did you write about anything from your time here in Roanoke, or was it mostly about your childhood?
I haven't gotten to that. See, I plan to quit the stories at the end of World War II.
Okay.
The night the war was over. I remember that so well. Oh Lord! Everybody I knew went to Harrisonburg, and we all and rode in cars round and round, tooting, booting. It was really something. I also remember VE Day. It's terrible.
VE Day.
That's the VJ Day. VE was the invasion of Europe.
Okay.
That was VE Day. Yeah. Oh yeah, that morning, see, we didn't know it when we left the house, but by the time we got to Harrisonburg that morning, it was out that that we had invaded Europe. France, and all the churches in town had their bells ringing. It was very somber. It was terrible.
Do you mean for the big amphibious invasion? D-Day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, D-Day, yeah. D-Day.
Yep.
Yep. V-Day, V-E-Day was the day the war was over, that's it.
Okay.
In Europe.
Okay.
No, D-Day. And see, those guys in Harrisonburg were in the same big unit that the Bedford guys were.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, what is it? I always forget.
I don't remember which one, but it was something unbelievable. 20-some folks died.
Well, that was just from Bedford.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Harrisonburg had some, but nothing like, everybody knew that Bedford had the worst. And I never did understand why. I'm sure there's a reason why so many of them were concentrated. Although those boys were the main, the ones from that group went from Harrisonburg, Newmarket, up that way. Not to Richmond, this side of the mountain, I guess, east or west of the Blue Ridge. That's where it was. the big division. That was apartheid. But you know, the war itself was not really that, that sounds so trite, but it's true. It wasn't really that hard on us at home because I realize now we were really shielded. We were shielded by where the battles were, but we were shielded by, like when the guys came back, I don't remember any of them telling us about it. They, now we'd go to parties or they'd get together in place, they, but then they'd get started in a little group and they'd tell each other war stories. They never did tell us. And I didn't even think to ask them, you know, I just thought, I thought about it, but I thought, well, you know, if they want to tell it, they will. It was really, there's some really brave guys out from there. Leon Garber was, he was a captain in the Marines, and he was a detonator in the Pacific. And he got a silver, no, what's the one bigger than a silver star? The next level.
The medal of honor?
No, no, he didn't get that. But the one right below.
I don't know what the levels are.
I don't either. But anyway, he is. And there were right many. Well, I knew a guy here in Roanoke who got a silver star. He was dropped behind the lines in Germany. He got caught. He was. He had just about five other guys. They were at a barn for I don't know how many days before they could get away and get back to their unit. It wasn't a Sunday school picnic, but no. But we didn't see it on television.
Not every day.
But I tell you what we did do, though. We used to sit at night and listen to the radio. I can remember so well. Daddy and Mother had, they had a, you know, the stand-up things, but I don't know why. I think it didn't have as good a reception as one of the later little radio. Because I can remember that little radio in that living room. We'd all sit around sometimes in the dark and listen to the news. I can remember my dad, just sometimes he'd be just, oh, during the Battle of the Bulge, just brave. And one of the boys in my book died in the Battle of the Bulge. He had all kinds of promise. He was one of the most promising kids that ever grew up there.
Oh, man.
He went into a building filled with armor, with armaments, and blew it up, and blew himself up too. Saved it. God knows how many others' lives, but you just can't think about it. Somebody you knew so well. He was my brother's best friend. I remember when his letter came back. Things like that, you know, that it's not bragging. You just remember and you just realize that it's, that the world's so far into what my children knew and what my grandchildren know. We didn't have any of the electronic stuff. We had a radio.
Speaking of electronics, like the recorder.
And yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But they had these awful. What was it? Tape. Wasn't tape. What was it? They first. What was the first recorder?
Was it like an 8-track?
Huh?
8-track?
No, I'm just thinking about what was the first thing that was used to. It was film, wasn't it? It was like on film, used to record people's voices.
I think it was a small little cassette recorder.
I guess it was, yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. It was terrible. You could never get it to work.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've told you or said anything, you know, that you really needed or wanted, but it's fun.
It is fun. And you have told me a lot. Who knows? We might have to do it again sometime.
I'd like it.
Yeah. We're probably at about that wrap-up time, yeah, and I don't want to get you to the point where you're so tired you don't want to talk to us anymore.
No, it's not that. It's just, I think I've just, you know, I've sort of talked about it.
I understand. Well, I thank you very much for your time today, Warren.
Oh, I really love it. You know anybody likes to talk about their childhood.
Well, it's fun, too, listening to you because growing up in Bridgewater, and then living in Richmond, and then moving here. I mean, you really got the rural, the urban, and the kind of in between.
Right.
And now it's more of the urban, but then, from what you're saying, it was more of the rural.
Oh, but Roanoke is like a big town. It's just outgrown, you know, just not outgrown, but just grew and grew and grew. It's not, Roanoke has never had the feel of a city to me, like a city, even Richmond. Even Richmond wasn't really a city like Washington. And,
right.
New York, but still and all. But, see, Richmond just went bad. that it just allowed it downtown to just become all black and all, and just stay sort of like, just get there behind that line, kids, and shut up. And of course they didn't. They just acted out all the time. And so, I don't know, the policemen here were different. I can remember Matt Nash. And this was a white friend of ours who was, he just had a terrible drinking problem. And he was just kind of, I don't know if he's spoiled or what, but he was a real cute kid, you know. And he was always into trouble. And I remember Matt, I've forgotten where they were, because this kid was, let me see, he was younger than my husband, but he was, you know, of that generation. And he was someplace in this area, and Mac told him, he said, "You go home." And the kid said, "I can't walk." And so Mac put him in his car, police car, took him home, took him into his mother and told her, you know, he was drunk and said he's afraid he'd get hurt. Instead of just put him in the slammer, that kid, he died though anyway. And he went into the Navy and this you just can't imagine, but this is what kind of kid he was. He was on one of the boats, you know, one of the boats that you get on to get into a big boat, mm-hmm. and his boat was leaving. He was going to miss his boat, you know, he'd have been AWOL. And so he was in such a rush that he tried to jump from one boat to the other, and he didn't, and he missed it, and he went down in the boat. He missed it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to laugh, but you know, you could have just seen his future. Like Leonard Keaton. I mean, there's just some people, some kids you know are just never going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
But as your life demonstrates, you keep trying, and
that's
hopefully
right.
There's a lot of
that's
them that still make,
to do.
Still
yeah.
make it.
Nothing else to do. You can either do it or turn your back.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a lot harder.
It's awful. I just can't. I don't know. I try not to judge anything or anybody, you know, because you can't compare lives. But I just can't imagine living a life here. I wasn't engaged. You know, I just think that's what life is to me, is to be engaged.
And that very adequately describes why you're so interested in neighborhoods.
I am. I'm interested in. I'm really interested in Roanoke. I really hope and pray that Roanoke, the school systems will, and the parents and everybody, I really feel that that's where the big undone work is still to be done. And I don't know how to, you know, it's just such a big job, because I know from experience the only way change really comes about is from person to person. I don't know of anybody in this world who's overcome anything that couldn't say, well, that was because of Mr. So-and-so, or Ms. So-and-so, or my daddy, or my mother. You know, and I just think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hi.
I heard your voice.
Yeah.
You have my cigarettes.
What? No, I don't have them.
Okay.
You know, the nurse has them downstairs.
Okay. Thank you. I'm
sorry, Mom. Oh, that's
fine. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get into trouble at TAP with the blacks, you know, because I'd say that. I'd say, look, the system can only do so much, and I used to say, you've got to, I said, not just blacks, but I said, all poor people have got to learn they've got it within themselves to really, if they get together, to get what they needed. And I really think that's true.
And they gave you a hard time for that?
Oh, yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
They say you don't know what it's like, and I'd say, I know I don't, but I also know I know what it takes. I know what my parents meant to me, and I can't imagine, you know, being anything, feeling like I could do anything if it hadn't been for them. That's the other thing, is people just, all you need to do is just know that you are as important as anybody else, and you just have to speak up, and you have to say it. What you think is right. Anyway.
All those life lessons, right?
Right.
Wilma, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm so glad to get to know you.
It's been a pleasure.
And you are But you're doing graduate work.
I am. It's,
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bedford.
Did you? Oh, and, Bedford's a good place.
Lived there. I was born in Baltimore, but then pretty quick after that moved to Bedford. My folks did, and I lived there through high school, and then left for a year and came back and went to Ronald College. Lived in Salem.
Mm-hmm.
Very good school. And then I lived in Covington for a year with a job, and then I moved to Richmond for about a year and a half. And
what did you do in Covington?
I worked for the health department.
Because my brother Harry, that I love so much, mm-hmm. he died when he was 27. He lived in Covington. He had four children. He had a one-time-only heart attack and died when he was 37. But
that's young.
But he really made a mark of the athletic field in Covington's named after him, Casey Field.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I remember that. You know, we went over there for that dedication.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. We could not understand how Harry could live in Covington and like it after he lived in Bridgewater, but he did. He loved it. He loved the people.
There's good people out there. Mm-hmm. Well, it's same as anywhere.
I know.
My wife complains about the way the paper mill smells, Mead, West Vaco. And then I said, but there's good people.
I know. And there is. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would have died years ago. Sometimes I used to tell Bobby, his wife, I'd say, the reason there are good people is the only way you can keep people here is by being good to people, because nobody else would stay.
Might be some truth to that.
Yeah, well, people who live there say they don't smell it, though, usually, unless the wind's blowing the wrong way.
Unless it's a real bad day. I grew to not really notice it that much as well. Let me turn this.
Yeah. I know. It's done.